I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. The art forger, the bad check writer, the so-called antiques, the sincere but made-up letter of reference from a renowned family. Gina Borecka is here to talk about fakery, the way it's done, who does it, and why. The chutzpah. Gina Borecka is a longtime contributor on the show with us from the beginning. She's author of many books, including It's Not That I'm Bitter. Welcome back, Gina.
Thank you so much, Faith.
Who, if I said name a person, who is the big faker looming into your mind?
Chesterton. This was a Chesterton, that marvelous boy. I think I'm getting this right. I mean, this was a young man who said that he had, the dates are back to the, I think it's the late 1800s, who had decided that he was going to make his name by saying that he had found these antique poems that he had found. He was going to go back and he had discovered these long lost poems. I think that they were supposed to be medieval, and that he had actually written them. And he was discovered to be a fake. It was a huge scandal. The poems were actually very good. They were lyrical. They were lovely. And he was referred to as, you know, by other poets as Chesterton, that marvelous boy. But he committed suicide. You know, his discovery, the scandal of discovering that he had made everything up was too much for him.
And before this, had he been famous?
No, he was really a very young man. And so it was somebody sort of hoist by his own petard. Now, I should have done my research on this because I wasn't expecting that as the first question, but that is the first person who comes to mind.
And I think of contemporary people. I think of Madoff and the whole line.
Right. A sort of a Ponzi scheme. But this was somebody who simply, I guess, you know, didn't trust his own ability to write and so wanted to be the discoverer, like when you're talking about the forged antiques. But this was something that he actually invented. This was somebody who actually had the ability but didn't believe it and so needed to footnote himself.
The tragedy, of course, is the talent that gets revealed with some of these fakers. I mean, some are ridiculous, but some, there are many who display, who's the one, I'm astonished most recently, not by Madoff, but by the art forger, the person who painted all of these paintings of the great masters. They finally figured this whole scheme out, but all the experts who saw these paintings said, oh no, that's a real Monet.
Pollock, this is a real, right.
And I think, who is this person? Somebody's got to do a profile on this remarkable talent that someone could, I mean, some people do this legitimately.
Right. Well, I mean, legitimately.
And he was selling to a woman legitimately, but then she pretended they were real.
Right. And see, this is where we go to, this is such a fabulous topic because even if we talk about it on the grander scheme of somebody forging art, whether it's poetry, artworks, antiques, but then in our regular lives, we have people who forge emotions. We have people who are scary because they can imitate so well. And one of my favorite novels is The Good Soldier. I often begin my modern British literature classes with that novel by Ford Madox Ford. And he opens with the idea of saying, if you have a good apple for 9 months and you only discover at the last day of that 9 months that it's rotten, have you had for 9 months a good apple? It's like if you don't know something is a fake, if you don't know something is inauthentic, if you don't know something is pretending, you think it's authentic that whole time. Have you had for that length of time something real? Does something real depend on your belief in its authenticity, or does it depend on what it actually is?
Did you have friends who were split when, what was it, Fry? You know, they pretended it was the memoir,
right?
And it wasn't
a million little pieces.
You know, it was made up, and you know it. And then he later said that the publishers are the ones who forced him into this position, and they suggested that he didn't. Well, I had half of my friends who think about things like this said, you know, I don't care that it was made up. It's still what he chose. It is still a memoir. A memoir can be anything. And I was a little stuck on, really, did you have to lie about it? And So, but they began to convince me that there is, you know, what is the difference between someone, you know, saying I've convinced myself this is true. I need this to be true. Here's what I'm presenting to the world. I mean, maybe the memoir is that he did something like this.
Yeah, that's a really interesting to go back to, Frey, because it's, I think that a memoir is different. You do expect somebody to have put in the time. You do expect somebody to have had some version of that experience, because otherwise it's, there's a kind of cross-dressing involved, which is not to say that the experience of it isn't while you're in costume, while there's a kind of minstrelsy, there's a kind of ventriloquism where you're speaking as if you have gone through something, especially Frey is talking about being an addict, right, and being in recovery, and he was supposed to have been in jail for a long time. He's talking about his incarceration, that people who have been incarcerated, people who have gone through long periods of recovery, I think believe that their experiences have won them or earned them, or, you know, they have paid for the right to talk about that, to have lived through that in a way that somebody who has a really good imagination about it.
Compare that to an author who either colludes with a publisher or fools the publisher too and pretends that he or she is someone else. This may be a famous writer already who wants to submit a manuscript under another name or thinks they'll never take it, so I'm going to pretend I'm this person. This is lying. How is this different from what Frey did?
You've discovered that I write under the name Edith Wharton, haven't you, Faith? I mean, all those books, we just pretend.
Jane Austen,
it's really tough. I mean, I keep going in and saying, can I sign my books? You know, it's Edith Wharton. And what's sad is so many booksellers now allow me. They go, oh, Miss Wharton, yeah, we've sold a few of your copies, but, you know, we don't sell them in hardback anymore. I'm always disappointed.
So, come on. Is there?
That's different. I mean, to write under a pseudonym, I think, has a kind of a legitimacy. I would love to write under a pseudonym. I think that would be great.
Yeah.
I think
that freedom would be comes with that.
Well, yeah. I mean, anonymity. I mean, there's something about anonymity that's really different from lying, from claiming that you've had an experience that you haven't had, you know, which is what fiction.
Well, yeah.
I mean,
why can't we learn as much from what Frey did in his made-up prison time and drugs and all that stuff?
Yeah.
As a fiction writer doing the same thing, we'll take a work of fiction and say, I learned so much from that. And all those fiction writers weren't in prison.
Right.
And
using
drugs,
absolutely.
But they had an ability to channel the experience,
right,
to know what it is, to write about it in an affecting way. What's the difference?
Because that's different from saying, I went through it myself. I really think that there's a very big difference. And storytellers fall into this. I got several years ago, but it's still one of the things that makes me proudest in life. I got from the Girl Scouts of Connecticut, I got their storytelling badge. And that was just an amazing accolade. I have it up on my wall. And I remember when I got up to speak to the group and I said, first of all, from the Girl Scouts, I was never a Girl Scout. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and there are Girl Scouts in big cities, but, and they do, you know, great work with girls from big cities. But I said, you know, I didn't know that birds had different names. I didn't know there were different kinds of trees. And I said, storytelling is just great because in my family, we called it lying. You know, I didn't know you could call it story. I didn't know birds had different names. I didn't know there was a way to frame what I did as storytelling. So for me, it was an accomplishment to have that recognized. But it's sort of, I teach at UConn, I teach creative nonfiction. So you get the creative inside nonfiction. And one of the interesting things with the students is always to figure out, where does the creative part come in? It's not journalism. You're not, you know, looking for source material. One of the assignments, for example, they have to write about their first day of kindergarten compared to their first day of college. Now, most of them remember vividly their first day of college, but they might not remember all of the details about their first day of kindergarten. I say, what you don't have the facts on, you're allowed to invent. So if you have to remember a version of what you used to wear to kindergarten, it's important to the girls particularly. So if somebody says, I wore a tutu, go-go boots, and, you know, a feathered hat, that's a version of what she wore to kindergarten every day, even if it wasn't exactly
and
it.
And can she call that a memoir?
She could call that a memoir, as long as there are pictures of her at five wearing a version of that, even if it wasn't what she wore on her first day. There's enough evidence that she had done that, that that's an authentic memory.
So what about the writers who, say, go into have been present in a political campaign and then come out, and all of a sudden you're reading this story of what went on in the campaign and all these exact quotes. And they say in interviews later, well, it's a representation of what happened there. But this is essentially, this is the spirit of what happened in the room. And I think, really? Do you get to do that? You get to put actual words in people's mouths that they said these words in this position? You know, so
well,
this is legal.
Well, this is, I think that what, as far as I know about how journalists do it, and again, I'm not a journalist, and that's the great, you know, there are those lines where you get to cheat a little bit. Like, as a columnist, I get to cheat because I'm a columnist. I'm not a reporter. I'm not a journalist. So if I, let's say, sum up what somebody said, what I try to do is to do something, and I think that this is what some of the, especially the political writers are talking about, is to do something that's representative without ever being misleading. So that what you're right, that you're sort of saying something, this is the typical thing that somebody is saying. But if you're saying that it's verbatim, verbatim means, you know, exactly, it's the truth of the words. I mean, that it is exactly those words. So I think that
But there's now a genre that where this is allowed. And, you know, nobody's getting the Frey treatment. You know, there are so many exceptions made. I mean, this is what the kind of conversation that was started from what happened to him. And that's why it's so interesting for us to talk about.
No, it is. I mean,
the larger world of fakery. Gina Bareka is here. And we're going to come up to a short break. But we want to talk about the kind of talent that it takes to be a sociopath. no, seriously. It takes tremendous talent. I mean, this goes so far. I mean, people have gone into surgery without medical degrees and, you know, started operating on people. I mean, this is what we're talking about. We're going to take a quick break and then more on fakery and the fakers who fake it. Stay with us. Our conversation on fakery continues. Find out what we talk about on this show online anytime or now at WNPR.org. You can find at this moment delicious recipes for dinner, value wines, easy cocktails, and much more. Click on programs at WNPR.org for the Faith Middleton Show. Gina Bareka is here. We're having a great time. We thought, let's start the new year off with a little spice, so we decided to talk about fakery. What's the movie where the guy comes into the lives of this well-to-do couple and does he pretend that he's a relative of theirs, or he's best friends with their son?
Is it six degrees of separation? That was one of them. But what I was thinking about when you were talking about sociopaths was The Talented Mr. Ripley, which is the movie with Matt Damon and Jude Law and Gwyneth Paltrow, and where this is somebody who I think of him as the real sociopath, but wonderful. I mean, absolutely engaging, because he pretends to be what he isn't. And what you're looking for is the slippage, you know, where
the tell.
Right, exactly. Philip Seymour Hoffman is the only one who's thinking, this isn't somebody who he seems to be. You know, there's something wrong. This is not a kid from Princeton. This is not, you know, he's not fitting in. There's something inauthentic about him. It's sort of like knocking, you know, on the piece of wood to realize that it's hollow. There's something that's not ringing true about it. But when you've got, it's sort of like if you can pass because it's about sort of passing, right? I mean, it can pass for real. And so what do you need to do to have establish your credentials enough to have people then invest their belief that you're the real thing and then pass you off on it? Would you go ahead.
So this actors talk about in dialogue with another actor, what does my character want? And so this person comes into the scene. I mean, these sociopaths who do this kind of stuff, they're coming into this scene in real life, and they know what they want. And so when they, which is to be seen as this, to be elevated usually, to be endowed with some kind of expertise, they know exactly what they want. And so they go into the acting performance in real life, and they're so convincing. They're brilliant actors. I mean, and then I become interested in, do they, on some level, you know, because of, we've got a mood disorder or what, do they believe it? Or are they all the time saying, I'm lying, I'm lying, I'm lying, I'm lying? Is that the backdrop conversation in their heads? Or do they kind of believe that they are this person?
I think that's a great question. But that, as soon as you say that, I think, oh, my God, but am I really the real thing? I mean, isn't that, you know, that I'm thinking about all of those times when I feel like an imposter. Mm-hmm. I mean, because then, you know, I'm always trying. I always feel that one of the great lines from Bossy Pants by Tina Fey is that she says, you know, whenever she, for years, that she would walk into production studio or for a script meeting or to go to some, you know, fancy executive thing with producers. And that she said, I would look like I was there to clean their aquarium. That's one of my favorite lines, because I have felt my whole life that when I have walked into some meeting somewhere, people think, oh, she's here to clean the aquarium. It's like, you know, that she can't be. Oh, we were expecting somebody entirely different from you. I mean, we didn't. And so that there's the imposter thing that you deal with, even when you're really, you know, who you are. I mean, you're actually a writer, or you're actually a teacher, or you're actually whatever you are, and you still feel like a fake. And so then the question is, how do people who are fakes, how were they so good at being so convincing? You know, is it, you know, where does that come from? Now, of course, I was on the way here, I was thinking about us doing the show, and I thought the idea about confidence, right? Now, a con man
is a confidence man,
right? A con artist is a confidence artist, because the only thing they're trading on, the currency that they trade is made up, is their confidence, is their ability to sell themselves to us. And we trade in that currency. So that whether it's, you know, it's Burt Lancaster as a preacher in The Rainmaker, whether, you know, whoever it is.
A car salesperson.
I mean, who is, but they're selling to us. I mean, at least there's a vehicle there. You know, I mean, but they're selling to us their image of who they think we want to be. I mean, they're trading on also what we want, not only what they can project, but what they know we want. Not only what they want to be, but what they can tell, what they can intuit that we want from them.
Because they're part of their task in knowing what they want is, you know, they know, they're saying to themselves, what I want is to say exactly the right things, right, to win you over to my side, that so you believe in me, so you buy my item, so you
have confidence
take
in me
into your family as one of you, and then I too am rich, or whatever it might be,
right?
And now this gets fascinating. We're talking about fakery with Gina Baraka. This gets fascinating when you think about people who so believe in what they are doing and they are completely fakes. There's that story of that man, I think more than one, who went in, it was really operating on people.
Yes, several
in
doctors
surgery.
Yeah.
In operating on people, it just had said, and I think was interviewed later and said, you know, I knew I'd always had a facility for medicine, for doctoring, for I'm interested in this field. I knew I could do this. How amazing.
Okay, but I think that if we're thinking of the same story, he also didn't have any worse a record than other surgeons. This was, I'm serious. I think, I mean, I
so
can't
he
remember.
He was good at it.
He was good at it. That this was somebody, and there's a character in Faye Weldon's Life and Loves of a She-Devil, who's a plastic surgeon and who's like a world-renowned plastic surgeon and who started out as a car mechanic. And he said he realized that it was essentially the same thing. It was connecting tubes and it was making sure you understood.
Isn't she funny?
And it was, but it was perfect that this was somebody and who was an excellent plastic surgeon. But this is where we're back to what is this, what does the faking it mean? I mean, if you fake it and then you're good at it, then are you a fake? You may be uncredentialed, you may be whatever, but I mean, are you really a fake? But then what do you do?
Well, can we trust you in other areas is what this raises, because you lied to get here. Mm-hmm. When does this kick in again?
But then we're back to the Ford Maddox Ford. If you believe in it for all that time and then you find out it's bad, has it been bad the whole time? I mean, is it like, you know, the cartoons? Is it Bugs Bunny when he runs off the cliff and he's staying straight, he's in the air, but he's perfectly, you know, at ease until he looks down and then he realizes there's nothing underneath him and then he falls? Are we upheld in all our beliefs by simple trickery? You know, that if we looked at how much everybody in the world has screwed up. If we looked at every surgeon, every politician, every administrator, every person who's put anything together, and, you know, every engineer.
Interviewer.
But every engineer for every bridge, every building, every architect, and we looked at every failure that they've had. I mean, would we ever walk out of our houses?
But well, I think you're saying, your point is, fakery everywhere.
Absolutely.
When does it cross a line? This is all, who has generous judgment about these kinds of things and who doesn't? We see cheating on tests. We see cheating in the military. We have zero tolerance policy. We have people who believe in shades of gray in their judgments.
Right. Not in the book. Ever in the book.
And never. You know, now we're in a three strikes and you're out land and courts being forced to follow guidelines, even when their judgment is you don't deserve to be in jail for stealing this record album.
Right.
So this is the world we live in. Very fluid about these things.
But I think that there's still something fundamental and something that is about the construction, creation, and maintenance of community that depends on trust. And that you cannot have trust if there is an acceptance, a really wide acceptance, that fake is okay.
Well, so if someone, you know, we see people who've committed very serious crimes who turn their lives around from all the evidence and become professors at universities in Connecticut, who've done horrific things and aren't hiding it and are allowed into high positions in government. You know, some accept it, some don't, but they have risen above their circumstances. And people looking at the trajectory of the life say, it was horrible back then, but I see from that point, you changed, and I'm going to have faith in you that you will stay this way.
Right. And I think that that's different from the idea of faking. I think that faking is somebody who has pretended to be something they're not. There's a kind of, it's more than just hypocrisy. I mean, I think that when we're talking about, let's say, a politician who has been all about family values and slamming other people for their, let's say, sexual choices or for what they've done, and who himself has been out having, you know, lots of trivial, frivolous, demeaning sexual encounters with strangers, whatever, you know, tapping his foot in stalls in public places, you know, wherever that was, and then saying, oh, no, but you can't do things like that. I mean, and then if he comes out and says, no, I've changed my ways, then we've got, I think, a lot of skepticism and says, you know, let's go, honey, you have to prove that. I mean, because we are unlikely to just offer him trust because we see somebody like that as a hypocrite, right? Where
I think the phrase you're looking for is wide stance.
Wide stance.
that was the claim.
The wide stance. Well, I think that that's different from somebody who says, I am going to, again, to be evangelical about it, who says, I am pure and I'm
the
going
preachers.
To the right
the
exactly.
lying preachers
that is somebody different from just a hypocrite. It's a whole new level.
What about the fakery for good reason? Spies who think that the country is going to be, people are going to be murdered or bombed in the country, and so they're spying to prevent something awful from happening. Mm-hmm. The French resistance, the people who protected, you know, hid Jews because the Nazis were coming after them. There are a zillion examples like this. Gay people who mm-hmm. fear I'll be fired mm-hmm. for my life. A person from a certain nationality or religion who says, I'm changing my name because I won't get a fair shot in this world if I don't.
No, that's all of those things. But I guess I don't see that. No, you're right, fake. That's a really interesting point. I guess it is. It's faking, especially when you talk about, you know, I'm thinking about in the 1920s or the 1930s when gay couples would go out with a beard. Right,
yeah,
which I always loved as an expression with
a
person of the opposite sex,
a fake partner,
which leads to endless wonderful screwball comedies that we watch now, and we think that so clearly who those people are, and I can't imagine that everybody didn't know it then, and that kind of camouflage for self-protection, which is that's what it seems to me, is fakery like protective coloring. I mean, that's fakery like you have to be in the wild so that the predators aren't going to get you. That seems to be a very different kind of motivation from somebody who is doing it for gain.
But it's fakery.
You're right. It's fakery.
You know, I mean, if we're going to do the black and white version of this, people
right.
would say it's fakery. But it's in its own classification because it's fakery for good reason.
But then we could say, I mean, if we're going to do the whole spectrum, then all of art is fakery. I mean, all legitimate art is fakery because mm-hmm. it's taking
the novel's
the real,
a fake.
Everything is a fake. I mean, mm-hmm. really, and that's where the puritanical, the most, again, the scariest of religious beliefs says you can't use representation because it is somehow mocking the original creator who created everything perfectly, and so that then to make a representation of what is already perfect is to mock the original creator. So there can't be dance, there can't be mm-hmm. music, there
sculpture.
Can't be art, there can't be sculpture because that is, or cartoons, you know, because that is somehow going to be a defacement of God's original plan. I like to think God has a better sense of humor and is a little more generous and has given people talents for certain reasons. You know, that then comes sort of under the heading of artificial. That's artifice, and that's art. And that fake, you know, from falseness comes from deception. Art's not trying to deceive you, where something that's fake is trying to deceive you for a reason and for its own purpose.
There's a book called Fakes, and it's an anthology. And it's edited by David Shields and Matthew Vollmer. And they went to all kinds of people, writers we know and perhaps don't know, and said to them, we would like you to contribute to our anthology and do pseudo interviews, to do a fake lecture, to do a fake letter to someone, to pretend that you found this magnificent text and what here, you know, so make up the text
like
that you've discovered,
right?
Like Chesterton. And all kinds of other fraudulent artifacts in this book. It's fascinating, so talented. And here are legitimate people, you know, who are so good at being fakers.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, just terrific.
That sounds wonderful. And that's where what's really scary is that sometimes when people fake something and they're doing it as a deliberate parody, they're doing it as a satire, then people take it for real.
Well, was it War of the Worlds?
Look at that
radio show where people thought the world was, we'd been invaded by space aliens.
Right. That's, well, and actually some people still think. That was true. It explains a lot about some people I saw recently on the bus. But it was, but I'm thinking even of something like Jonathan Swift's, you know, A Modest Proposal, where he suggests that the way to end starvation is for people to eat their babies, because that solves starvation and overpopulation at the same time. And so it's a modest proposal. So he's writing this, Swift, great satirist of his day, who wrote Gulliver's Travels. And people were like, you know, horrified by this idea. I mean, it's clearly a funny thing. And students today
think it's serious.
They were like, my God, people did that in England. It's like, no, honey, it's satire. Let's explain the nature of satire. And if we cannot see satire as something funny, as a comment, as a way to overturn what we take for granted so that we could see how absurd it is. If we can't push something to a level of absurdity, it doesn't work.
So, Gina, stay where you are. I want to talk about people cheating on each other, because this is one of the most common of fake systems that we've got. So we're going to do that with Gina Borecka right after this break. I'm Faith Middleton. It's great to have you listening. You can tweet us at FaithWNPR, FaithWNPR. Join the conversation with us on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks to you for listening and to our talented team, senior producer Lori Mack and producer Jonathan McNichol. And Gina Borecka, our guest, longtime contributor to this show almost from the beginning, and is author of many, many books, including It's Not That I'm Bitter. And we're talking about fakery, fakes.
Yes.
People who fake it, which would include all of us.
Yes.
At one time or another, and perhaps consistently. So, here we are. It is a very fascinating. There's faking for good reason. There is all that borderline fakery. And then there's sex.
And there's faking attraction. There's the whole fake it till you make it. This has been advice that I've been seeing recently. I love advice columns, right? So I read them wherever I can. I really, I love them. My favorite is E. Jean Carolyn L. She's the smartest woman writing advice columns. And she is never a fake it till you make it. But everybody else, because she just says, if you don't like somebody, leave that relationship. There are a lot of other people, or be alone. But a lot of other columnists will say, oh, well, if you're not so attracted, stay longer. See if you could make it work. Even if you're unhappy, no, you want to actually put your eye out during a meal. You know, you could live with one eye. I mean, I'm reading these things going, run away. It's so much harder to pretend to like somebody. Just as it's harder, this is what I tell my students, if they want to fake, you know, doing the work for the class, they'll go read Spark Notes. They'll go read ridiculous stuff online written by people who are trying to make money to go to the track. You know, these are not authorities on the works. These are people who are trying to buy drugs on the streets or writing a synopsis and putting it on, you know, on online of a great work of literature. I'm going, why would you trust these people? So I said, it is harder to read that stuff online than it is to read the great work of literature, which is well written.
So you're on the edge right now of talking about fooling oneself.
Right.
You can be faking it to yourself.
Absolutely. Where you think that, but it's harder to fake it to yourself. But people, for example, stay in relationships. And I did this once for several years in my early youth, in my first youth, where I kept telling myself that the relationship was good enough. And I'm really scared because I know that this could have been my life. Because it was like, oh, it's not so bad. It's not so bad. And then I like woke up. My fairy godmother came, something. And it was like, no, you know, this cannot be the rest of your life. And so when my students come in and they say, oh, well, I think I'm going to marry my best friend. I said, like, is this someone you're in love with? Well, I don't know if I'm in love. I don't think I'm in love. But what's in love anyway? I'm already 30 and I'm not married. And my mother thinks I should get married. So I think I could fall in love with them. I'm not really in love with them. I said, like, leave the relationship. You could buy a blender yourself, okay? You can actually buy matching sheets. You do not need to get married. And don't marry. I mean, maybe you can marry your best friend, but you don't have to marry. You could go out to dinner with your best friend, go to a movie with your best friend, marry somebody you feel passionately about. You know, if you're going to move in with somebody, marry, you know, be in this long-term partnership with somebody that you feel like you've got to be in this person's presence. You know, there are a lot of other people in the world to hang out with. And if you're faking it till you, you know, the whole, because I just read this in an advice column, that if you fake it until you think you're going to be able to talk yourself into something, that's the worst kind of faking it.
You know, though, I have seen, to the other side of this, I have seen women on occasion say to me, you know, I married him. Was he the love of my life? No. You know, did I have all that crazy romantic stuff about him? No. But he was a very good prospect. I knew this man was going to be trustworthy. He was going to be a good father to our children, and that we were going to be able to build a life together. And in fact, they did. And it seemed quite happy. And so, you know, I want to say maybe we have to be careful about the many shades of gray on this spectrum.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I just get scared with the idea that you can...
The settling.
Yes, the settling. And that that the faking it until you can talk yourself into believing it's okay. Because we're looking, so many of us are tempted not by the great grand feats of danger, but by just like, oh, isn't this good enough for me? And that's a kind of a faking it too. There's a faking it in thinking that you're not good enough to do something.
So you're talking about relationships. Let's get to sex.
Okay, sorry.
Okay. So, you know, as deep as that might be, let's move to something more superficial. So think of the amount of fakery among, you know, I mean, there's so many cheating people in the world.
Yes.
I mean, just across the world.
Yes.
And the stories, you know, a lot of them bad because they all get found out in the end. I mean, it's just like cheaters are really pretty bad liars.
Well, you have to have such a good memory to be a fake in anything, but to be a sexual cheat.
Credit card bill appears out of somebody's pocket in the laundry. And I think, really, you can't be better than that. Confront them and it comes spilling out, you know, in this kind of stupid way. And it's just unbelievable.
It's always a long story. You have to beware the long story. It's like if I found actually Gene Weingarten, my friend from the Washington Post that I write with, said he once came home from a trip away with a brassiere. I don't have to say a woman's brassiere, but with a brassiere in his suitcase.
You do if it's Seinfeld.
That was right. But it was like a 44 double D. And his wife is this tiny, petite, like size 2 woman. And she was, I guess, you know, she was in the room when he was unpacking. And he had this, like, you know, brassiere, 44 double D is a big girl. And she was like, oh, hi, what were you, you know? And he was like, it was for a skit that I was doing. And she was like, okay. And that was it, because there was nothing. It was for some skit they were doing for something about women and whatever. And that was it. And I thought if he was actually having an affair, there would have been some long explanation about how there was a mix up at the airport and somebody's luggage got, but only half of it came out. You can't. If you're telling the truth, it's just silly and stupid, but it's short. Lying takes a long time.
But then you meet couples and people have been going on with these affairs for 20 years and they're not caught. And I think now that is someone who's magnificent at pulling off the con.
Or
absolutely magnificent.
They're married to somebody who really doesn't care. That's the other
or want to know.
Or want to know, which is, again, another kind of faking it. It's like, okay, yeah, gee, every Friday night bowling, but you never take the ball out of the bag. You know, it's fine. She's put a note in one of those little holes in the bowling ball saying, if you ever put your finger in this, give me a call. And she's put that in there for 25 years, the wife, and he's never noticed it. You know, they have what might be called a deal.
So you hear on occasion these stories of two couples, best friends. Somebody in there is having an affair with somebody else in this foursome.
Right.
And it goes, and they do everything together. And it goes on and on and on. And for years before somebody breaks up the whole mess, mm-hmm. You know, so... How is that possible with that level of intimacy among these four people to not spot something.
Oh, but that, in fact, but now Faith, you take us right back to that. That is the plot of The Good Soldier. Because, and he's saying, the character is saying, I don't know how my wife could have had an affair because I was with her every minute. And it's told in the first person. And then about two-thirds of the way through the book, he goes, I realize as I'm telling you this that I said I was never, she was never out of my sight. She was out of my sight all of the time. You know, that it's only when you go back and you retell yourself the story, when you look at what actually happened, that you realize that your version of the narrative is actually different from what it was. But if we're going to go back to the real sexual faking, how about the sexual faking when people pretend they're happy in bed and they're not happy in bed? Mm. Now, is that good sexual faking or bad sexual faking?
Mm,
is it, you know, like
bad.
If you're pretending that,
that
you sounds... know, but it's, I say in fact, in the old, in Snow White, and they used to call me Snow White, but I drifted, that faking an orgasm is like faking laughter. It's like the,
right,
you know, because it's that laughter that women start doing when we're like, you know, young women and we're dating and we're going, and you're thinking, on the way home, I need Bounty towels. Is it five for $6 or six for $5? Because that's not a sound every woman has ever made when she's happy. When we're really laughing, we're going, which is a less feminine sound. But the faking your reactions of pleasure, the trouble with doing that is then you lose sight of what your real reactions of pleasure are. If you fake it too much, then you don't know when you're kidding yourself or not. Then you start to lose the ability to discern what's really making you happy from when you're kidding around with it. So I agree with you. I think that the faking it, you know, it's like, but then you can go to sleep already, you know? I just, you could just pretend that it's done. It's like faking the laugh. It's not worth it.
I once heard a therapist say, when I see couples and one of them has had an affair, I will sometimes say to them, you know, speaking to the woman, let's say, you are a magnificent actress. And, you know, if you look across the person's life, you see, oh, this was not only an amazing actress, but so compelling and so good at acting that she could pull this off maybe across her whole life for years with people. Now, that is amazing to witness.
But now is somebody...
And shocking to deal with.
But is somebody who, let's say, if you're raised in a family where your role was to please, right? That was your job in the family. You were supposed to be the conciliatory one. You were supposed to be the one who brought people together. You were supposed to be the peacemaker. You were supposed to be that. If you learn that, let's say, now... as a kid, and you had to learn how to repress your rage, you had to learn how to never ask anything for yourself. If you were going back to being an actress, let's say, your whole life, and always being the one who, you know, never asked for anything, but who always seemed to be doing things for other people, if you were the do-gooder, if secretly you have all of that rage and all the rest of it, is that being an actress your whole life, or is that just learning how to adapt?
I don't know. That sounds, it's a little bit like actress, I think.
Right. I mean, but if that, so is the actress only somebody who we see as self-serving, narcissistic, doing things for herself? Or can you be that actress, that actor, and be somebody who is in fact covering, you know, really great pain and great sorrow, but has just been cast in that role from, I mean, I think the phrase dysfunctional family is redundant. Who could ever say family without saying dysfunctional first?
No, Gina, really? This is amazing, subtle, beautiful point you're making.
Well, so that's always acting. I mean, that's just survival as a child. So how could you then take away, I mean, I'm, you know, 28 years of therapy has helped me learn to look at some of those, you know, ways that families, you know, shape people in them. And but it really does sort of it does sort of confuse us to say, what do you do with somebody who's learned how to do that from a very early age? How do you separate what's the fake from what's the real if that's what you've done since you're a child?
Gina, you were inducted into the Friars Club, so you're in there and you're having dinner. I was in there with you and we're having lunch and we're seeing all these comedians. You know, you made this point that in the end, comics are fakes and we love them. So you're in this category, as you point out, of the fakes we love.
I think that there is a category of fakes we love. Any kind of performer. I mean, the great chef is a fake on some level, isn't he or she? Because we watch them prepare all of this food, but we see them go through the stages. But when we watch, let's say, great food preparation on a television show, half of that stuff has been done in stages that we don't see. And that's part of what they're like a magician. Magicians are fakes that we love. We see them. The preparation has been done in ways we can't imagine.
And maybe by other people.
Right. And maybe by other people. And in ways we could never recreate because we don't know those secrets.
But is Dale Chihuly, the great glass artist, is he a fake because he is standing there directing his assistants to twist it this way, to mold the glass to the left, to put this stripe in it, to swirl it around here? In directing, is he a fake, you know? Or is he still truly the director and author of the finished piece that you see?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that's like, who, what author is it? Is it James Patterson or
yes,
the, who has, again, sort of like
minions.
Other writers. Right, like fleets, a stable of writers. Fleets, yeah, is nicer than stable. And, you know, sort of like Michelangelo with a studio full of authors, of painters who would do his work. And I think that, you know, a studio vision of art is certainly legitimate, and that would be, but then the artist becomes the conductor,
yeah,
as opposed to the single author. But in terms of going back to the idea of comics as fakes, a comic cannot get up there. Even Richard Lewis, the depressed comic who wrote, you know, The Next Great Depression, which is his autobiography, even the comics, or Rodney Dangerfield, who is a very great title, you know, with I Get No Respect, they have to be funny. I mean, their job is to be funny. So they have to perform their comedy. And so because you're not asking them to authentically get up there and talk about what they did that day. I mean, they may be seeming to speak off the cuff, but that is not their role. So people performing a role are not being inauthentic. They're not faking it. They're doing their job. And that's the difference between faking it and performing an act.
So is there a difference between performing and faking?
I think that performing is when you have already established a role that's distinct and separate from the rest of your life, where faking is the part that's scary because it's blurred. There's no boundary to faking.
You know, there are so many great actors who are fakers no matter what you just described, because they're introverted extroverts. They're incredibly shy, and yet they have this ability to get out there somehow and perform. And they go through life with this split personality, and so they have to fake. And we come across this when we interview them, you know, that someone's not necessarily a great interview, not necessarily, you know, needs a lot of coddling or a sense of real trust to be able to have a real conversation. It's not in their nature. So that duality is interesting to me in that field.
Right, because they can read lines that somebody else writes, but nobody is writing their lines in life. And I could never, I tried acting like in high school. I was the worst on earth. I could never do it because I could never be an adequate fake. I could never get it right. I could never get the nuance. I was a clod.
Wouldn't you like to know if you had a really good teacher, what would happen?
Now, I knew I'd be lousy.
No,
I would be lousy.
I don't know. All right. Gina Borecka, thank you so much. Author of It's Not That I'm Bitter. I'm Faith Middleton. And this show, I hope we spiced up the start of your new year with our discussion of fakery. As always, this show is about the richness of life. Find the books, people, great recipes, value wines, and cocktails we feature right now at WNPR.org. Click on Programs in New Haven. I'm Faith Middleton.